following is a recording of a sermon given at All Saints Lutheran Church in Ottawa, Canada. For additional messages and more information, visit allsaintslutheran.ca.
We're continuing our series in Colossians. This is part 7, and I've entitled this Reflecting Reality. Struggled a little bit because the theme of these passages seems to repeat, and there's a major thing going on in Colossians. The Colossian believers had come into a reality, but false teachers had come into their midst and tried to impress upon them that their experience of Jesus wasn't enough, and there were certain knowledge, certain experiences, and certain practices that they had to have in order to really be something, in order to really make it. And there's this expression, the tail wagging the dog. They had it backwards. And it's really, really important. Because there is a knowledge to know. There is an experience to be had. But it must always start with knowing God and Jesus. It starts with a relationship with Him. It starts with what He has done for us, and that He brings us into God's family. He brings us into God's house. We don't have a ladder to climb to get to God's house. He has brought us in through His Son, and now our lives are about exploring what it means to be God's children. It's not a matter of how can we finally arrive at being God's children. Oh, I haven't done enough yet. I haven't attained yet. I might be kicked out. No. We come into an experience of becoming God's children through faith in Jesus, and then we go exploring. We're brought into this great house of God. What's behind this door? What's in this cupboard? I wonder what's in the basement. I wonder what's in the attic. I didn't know. I didn't know we get to do this too. I didn't know we get that as well. I didn't know. And so there's things to learn, but it's exploratory. It's discovery. It's not attainment. There's a big, big difference. And so what we have here at the beginning of chapter 3, this is one letter. And sometimes people try to do this with all of Paul's letters, as if the beginning of Paul's letters is always theology, and then the latter part of his letter is the practice, the practical part. And that's a difficult grid to put on a lot of his letters, because he actually will go back and forth between what we might call theory and practice. In Colossians, he does spend a lot of time unpacking who we are because of what Jesus has done. Get that. That's the foundation. Okay, now that we've got that, how then shall we live? And that's mainly, we find that mainly in chapter 3, in the first part of chapter 4. So chapter 3 begins with, so if you've been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is seated at the right hand of God. So there's that, what we might call positional reality. You're in. So if you've been raised with Christ, and the word if can often mean since. It's a way of saying since. Since you've been raised with Christ, you're in this special place with Him. Just like Jesus died and rose, because you're in Jesus, you've also died and rose. You're with Him, where He is, seated at the right hand of God. There's something about the essence of our lives that's hidden away in the reality of who Jesus is and where Jesus is at in that place of authority with God in the heavenly places. And the heavenly places, besides it being where God is, it's the place of all authority. And going back to Adam and Eve, the connection of heavenly authority to life on earth had been broken, because human beings were to be the bridge between God and His ways and that which was happening on earth. Because Adam and Eve disobeyed God, that was broken. And the earth had become cursed, distant, distanced, made far away from God and his ways and his presence. And the story of the Bible is God rectifying that big chasm. And one day that chasm will be completely bridged in the new heavens and the new earth, as was read from the Isaiah passage earlier. But for now, we've got this, the reality without its fullness being seen in a full practical way. But for the believer, it's real. Our lives are wrapped up in the risen Jesus. He's waiting for his full revealing when he returns. And because our lives are wrapped up in him, when he returns and is revealed as the true Lord and King of all the earth, our nature, our identity, our place, our position will also be fully revealed. So it says, at the end of verse 4, you also will be revealed with him in glory. That's not just talking about Jesus coming with lots of shining. Glory has to do with honor. When Jesus returns, he'll be fully honored for who he is and what he has done. And because we are in him, we will be honored. We will be in our rightful place as the true children of God. That's our expectation. That's our inheritance. That's our future. And there's something about a reality of that to be experienced now, because our lives are wrapped up in Jesus during this special waiting period as we wait for him to return. As we wait for him to return, and as we are in this special place with him, as we are in a sense already raised from the dead, what are we to do? We get a little nervous when we start talking about what should we do. Especially in a letter like this, where it seemed that these false teachers had come in and was trying to tell the believers what they needed to do. You're not doing enough. You need to do this. You need to know the other thing. And Paul goes out of his way to impress upon them, no, no, no. It's not about that kind of attainment and achievement. But he's not saying you don't do anything. Paul's not saying that the believer lives a life of complete passivity. God's done everything. We just now kind of, you know, lie on the raft and we float down the stream and just kind of enjoy life. There's a life to be enjoyed, but we're to engage that life. We're to respond what God has done. Now, how we do it, why we do it, and what we do are all very important. So what Paul says here that we need to do is seek the things that are above. And when he talks about the things that are above, he's not simply saying, think about heaven. Join me in thinking about heaven. I don't even know how to think about heaven. Because, you know, we all immediately, it's clouds, right? Is it clouds? Is it shining? Like, I like doing these theme images for the sermons. I get a bit of a kick out of it, if I might be honest. Sometimes it's really hard. I actually took that picture. That's not far from our house. And the water in the pond was perfectly reflecting the trees. Anyway, so I really like that. But when we start talking about seeking the things above, like what kind of picture do you make? You know, golden columns floating in the sky. And we try to image heaven. But that's not what Paul is encouraging the believers to do here. It's not close your eyes and try to think heavenly thoughts. He's calling the believers. I don't know how to get rid of this pop. Try that. Okay, maybe move it back. I move back. Okay. What he's calling the believers to do is seek the things of heaven. Seek the perspective of God, not the perspective of earth. Every day, we're influenced by our impulses, by our desires, our objectives, other people. And we find ourselves driven unto thinking a certain way, planning a certain way, wanting a certain way, and so on. what is supposed to be influencing how we go about our lives? It's not the things of the earth. We were called from the beginning, going back to Adam and Eve again, to be stewards of planet Earth, serving God on this planet. When our first parents listened to the creation instead of the Creator, they became twisted and began to be the servants of the earth. And so that, because of sin, we're controlled by fleshly desires, human interests, emotions. Emotions are an important thing in our lives. They're a gift of God, but they should be subservient to us. They should help us to express what's really going on in our lives. But what happens, our emotions, our feelings are our lords. We live according to our feelings. We live according to other people. We live according to monetary and economic concerns. We live according to our sports interests, whatever it is. It's things of the earth. And all these things, other people are important, emotions are important, money's important. Sports can be important sometimes in its rightful place, as all leisure and entertainment can be. But when we're being driven by those things, we're being driven by the earth. We're not being led by heaven. And we need to willfully and purposely seek God's interests. Seek to hear God's voice. One of my prayers is, Lord, help me to not react to life, but to respond to your voice. Now, why do I pray that prayer? I pray that prayer because I react to life and don't usually respond to God's voice. So I pray it. And I pray it again. And I pray it again. And I pray it again. And that's in keeping with this verse, verse 1. The Greek verb that's translated seek the things that are above, the verb to seek, means keep on seeking. It's like when Jesus teaches us, keep on knocking and the door will be opened to you. Keep on seeking and so on. Keep on asking. It's not just ask and you're done and then wait. We've been called by God to diligently seek him. Not that we're working up a heavenly ladder, oh, if only I can reach God. But it's there. We've been thrown into this tension between the pull of the earthly things and the call of the heavenly things. Remember, I need to say it again. The call of the heavenly things aren't detached from earth. I'm just going to think about God and pray about I don't know what. What God wants is he wants to fill us with his truth and his presence and his goodness, and he wants to guide us so that we could be the best human beings this world has ever seen. We've been called to serve him on this earth. We do that in this community, formally as a church community. We do it wherever else he calls it, at work, at school, at play. We've been called to serve him. But the only way to serve him effectively and genuinely, authentically, is we need to hear his voice. In order to hear his voice, we have to seek him. Seek the things that are above. And this word above, when talking about the heavenly things, I know we tend to think of, you know, the heavens are up there and the earth is down here, but that's metaphor. It's a way of speaking of the heavenly realm is not fully yet integrated with the physical realm. And it will be when the Lord returns and he remakes everything, creates the new heavens and the new earth. The things of heaven and the things of earth will go together in the way that they were meant to be. And until then, we are that bridge between heaven and earth. I've used it before, I'm sure. I love the illustration of being an ambassador. I know we have people here who've worked in the diplomatic branch of government. But I've talked about this before, not simply meeting people like this. Where do you get your orders from? You find yourself in a foreign land, surrounded by their culture, their laws, and so on. But if you don't have regular contact with home office, you're going to become absorbed by the foreign land. You are called to serve the home office in the foreign land. And that's what we're called to do. We're heavenly emissaries. We're heavenly diplomats. We represent God on earth at this time. And the only way to do that is if we're continually informed by heaven. Because if we don't keep seeking the things that are above, we forget. And that's just how it works. And we become absorbed. We become acclimatized to the way things are around us. We begin to imitate what everybody else is doing. But then we're reminded. And remember, and there's a real problem among God's people today, I believe, in North America. We know we're called to serve people and to bless them and help them know the Lord. And yet what some people think is what we need to do is cater to their interests. And somehow we're going to represent God's will. They're going to like God if we cater to their interests. But that's not what people need. You know, could you imagine going to the doctor and the doctor caters to your interests? And if you know something is, if it's bad news, he's not going to tell you. If the procedure is going to hurt, he's not going to recommend it. That's terrible. Now, sometimes we say good news to people and make them happy. I've had that experience. I've shared the truth of God with non-believers and with people and told them things, and they get really excited. That happens. So I've told them the truth. Other times they might get really upset because it clashes with their desires. But their desires are killing them. Their desires are killing them. Why don't we tell people the truth about the path they're going down? Oh, we're called to be nice. Where does the Bible ever command us, thou shalt be nice? It's not there. We're to be good. We're to be loving. And sometimes, no, we shouldn't be ornery and arrogant and what's the word I'm looking for? Obnoxious. Thank you. We shouldn't go out of our way just to be, you know, prickly. Let's not do that. We should minister to people in the most effective and loving and gentle way possible. But let's tell people the truth. And let's tell ourselves the truth. Verse 5, put to death, therefore, whatever in you is earthly, fornication, impurity, passion, evil desire, and greed, which is idolatry. On account of these, the wrath of God is coming on those who are disobedient. These are the ways you also once followed when you were living that life. This is quite the list. Fornication, impurity, passion, evil desires, and greed. What appears to be happening here is this list that he is warning the people against seems to be starting with the worst kind of sexual sin and kind of working backwards to the heart, where actually it all begins. So what we have at the beginning of the list is the full-blown expression of sexual sin, and it ends up with where it starts in the heart. And he tells the Colossian believers to put these things to death. Now, he's writing to believers. If he's telling the believers to put these things to death, it implies that they were still doing them. Which is wild if you think about it. So that means there was a community of believers, and Paul wasn't saying put the people to death. He wasn't saying get rid of the people. He was telling people who were still committing horrid sin to stop it, which tells us we need to have very high tolerance for people and their lives. It doesn't mean we just put up with the sin, because we should be teaching this, telling people to stop sinning. I believe there's a very high tolerance in the New Testament for believers' dysfunctional lives, but low tolerance for leaders. People who are in service should always be good examples. It doesn't mean they're perfect, or we're perfect, because we're not going to be. But we should have very high standards for leadership, for people that are serving, but then we should be very, very tolerant with the people in general. That seems to be what the New Testament teaches. So he's telling the people to put these things to death. And that also is a continual thing. So these evil activities were existing in the community, and they're supposed to stamp them out. Personally, not, I don't stamp them out on your behalf. You stamp out your own issues. And this image, what I get from this is the image of, you know, those, and now it's with summer, the little, some of the, you know, the bugs are beginning to emerge in our homes. Some of them are pretty big. You know, some of those big ones, however they get into our houses, and you go to you know, send them to bug heaven, and you stamp on them, and they're still alive. And so you stamp on them some more. Oh, it's dead. No, it's not. It's still alive. That's how we're supposed to treat sin in our lives. Stamp, 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 stamp. Kill it. And that's it's sort of a funny kind of image, because usually when you kill something, you kill it and it's dead. I love that expression. Raid kills bugs dead. How else, you know, what other kind of killing is there? Except for this kind. Because this seems to be, you kill it and it's still there. So what do? Kill it some more. You kill it and 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 kill it. Now, I know sometimes we feel when we're addressing these things in our own lives, we're going to kill ourselves in the process. It could be pretty nasty. But we're supposed to kill it and 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 kill it. And what happens, it's, you know, just like we continue to ask God for forgiveness, as I mentioned earlier, and God in his awesomeness forgives us every time, we need to remember that as we continually and repetitively put to death those things that bring on God's destruction. You know, sexual sin is special. I know a lot of people like to teach all sin's equal. And all sin is equal in the sense that all sin invites God's wrath. So we've all sinned. It doesn't matter, and fall short of the glory of God, we read in Romans. It doesn't matter if it's big sin, small sin, this kind of sin, that kind of sin. People, in a sense, are all equally sinners. That's true. But not all sin is the same, in the sense that they don't all deserve the same kind of response. And there's something about sexual sin that says here, on account of these, the wrath of God is coming on those who are disobedient. There's something about breaking God's directives in the sexual realm that invite a certain type of negative response from God. And Paul may not simply be talking here about God's judgment at the end of time. He might be talking about how God relates to people who tolerate sexual sin. It's very, very serious. And note where it begins at the end of the list. Greed, which then he says, which is idolatry. Whenever we read this for the first time or the 10th or 100th time, it always sounds a little strange. If this really is a list of sexual sin, what does greed have to do with it? Well, it's everything. Because greed is the desire to have something which is not for you to have. And that's the essence of sexual sin. Cultivating a life that says, okay, here's what I have in life, but I want what is not for me to have, whether it's a toy, a car, a job, or a human being. Wanting what is not for us to have is in the essence. And one of the reasons why of the essence of sexual sin, and the kind of sin that invites God's wrath upon us individually and communally. One of the reasons why I understand it this way is, again, going back to the garden. You can eat of any of the trees, any of them. Any of them. And yet, they went after the only tree that God said, don't eat of. greed. The idea fed by the words of the serpent. God's keeping something back from you. You are not really fulfilled. You'll never be fulfilled with the abundance of fruit that God's giving you. You need something else. And that's the same temptation that comes to us every single time that we are lured into sexual sin, whether it's in our fantasies or in our activities, wanting something that God said, this is not for you. And we live in a day where sexual sin has entered the very fabric of the society. It's not something that's just over there. It has come into all of our homes, and it actually dwells in the pockets and purses of almost every single person in North America. 21st century pornography is the greed and the idolatry that Paul is speaking about here. Bringing up a subject like this is always is difficult. One of the reasons why it's difficult, it's not because of all the people who are addicted to it. It's because of the few people that don't really understand the situation that we're in right now in North America and in the church. So our son Joshua, some years ago, started Canada's first organization solely committed to fighting pornography. He had been addicted to pornography himself for 10 years, and the Lord delivered him and eventually called him to pursue this mission in helping men and women become free of this horrible scourge. And it is some people justify it because all it is looking at pictures or videos as if it's not something that they're actually doing, I guess. But it is all wrapped up in the entertaining of that which is not for us to have. It's this sort of dream world of engaging somebody who's not really there, but only looks like they're there, and filling ourselves with an excitement over that which is not ours to have. It's taking human beings and turning them into objects rather than the representatives of God that every human being is supposed to be, turning them into the tools of our pleasure. And that makes God angry. And we must kill it. Kill it, kill it, kill it, kill it, kill it. Whatever it takes. You may not know some of the statistics of porn use in North America and among Christians. But we're talking about regular use, pastors addicted at the rate of 50% or more. Now think about that for a minute. Every other pastor in Ottawa, according to the statistics, is addicted to pornography, and yet they're being allowed to preach in their pulpits this morning. Elders, deacons, board members, men and women. I don't have the time, and this is not really the place to get into all the stats. I can share them with you. We're talking about high percentage from a very young age and of a variety that is beyond some of our understanding. It is a trap, it is a scourge, and it's killing the church. And if we don't do what Paul says here and kill it, it will kill us. It must be addressed. It must be dealt with. And the good news is that it can. That in Jesus, there is freedom. In Jesus, there is help. The essence of the good news is that he's come to deliver us from sin and death and all of the ways that its tentacles have reached human beings. Don't feel bad thinking you're the only one who. Because if this isn't your problem, it's something else. There's other things in our lives that are dragging us down. And it's not going to be formulas or the next conference or listen to this or doing that that's going to be the magic thing that's going to free us. We have freedom in Jesus. Now we need to help one another. We need to confess our sin. There are things that we could do. But whatever it is, we need to kill it. I need to go quickly to the next thing because it's not fair to leave it there. Verse 8. But now you must get rid of all such things: anger, wrath, malice, slander, and abusive language from your mouth. Do not lie to one another, seeing that you've stripped off the old self with its practices and have clothed yourselves with the new self, which is being renewed in knowledge according to the image of the Creator. So the two things that Paul addresses that we need to get rid of: sexual sin and bad speech. Sexual sin and bad speech. We have to stop talking badly. It's unbecoming, it's ungodly, and it's dragging us down. It's destructive. There are elements of it that are not the same as pornography use and other sexual sin, but it's really, really bad. When he says don't lie to one another, that means we're to be completely honest. And you know, for some people, being honest is finally saying the horrible thing you always wanted to say to that other person. That's not what he's talking about. Our mouths need to reflect the reality of God. That means we need to talk to each other from God's perspective. Keep seeking the things that are above. God loves you. God forgives you. God wants to help you. God wants to deliver you. And if I'm having trouble with you, I've got to change. I've got to ask God for forgiveness. And I have to ask God to show me how to serve you and love you and be kind to you. And maybe I need to confront you in the sin you're trapped in. But to speak the truth in love. Gossip has to go. It has to be thrown into the garbage. It has to be killed. Are we reflecting God's truth with our mouths? Or are we speaking fleshly things? Every day, I struggle with how horrible I feel inside my body. And I tend to interpret my life based on how I feel. But I'm supposed to see myself as hidden in the heavenlies with Jesus. There's a real me hidden away that I not to understand through how I feel, but based on what God says about me. Each one of us has to speak about our own lives based on how God sees us. We need to be talking to other people on the basis of how God sees them. And we need to start speaking about other people according to how God sees them. Are we going to be heavenly-minded people or earthly-minded people? God, help us. How do we get there? Dwelling on the things of heaven. Worshiping the Lord. Thanking Him for all that He has done. And letting Him out. Because He saved us. If we've not come to know God through Jesus, today's the day. Ask God to forgive you for your sins and ask Jesus to come into your life and take over and be Lord. And then watch what happens. And then cooperate with all that He wants to do. And for those of us who've known Him for a long time, if we haven't been cooperating with Him and trusting in Him and believing in Him and obeying Him, now's the time to start.
Thank you for listening. For additional messages and more information, please visit us on the web at allsaintslutheran.ca.